Okay. We ended last time with some difficult concepts, and it was brought to my attention afterwards that perhaps things were not as clear as they should have been. So I want to briefly recap the points that were discussed last time and try to put them into the proper perspective, which basically involves two points. We were dealing with two problems last time. One problem was, this is what the Kuzari had addressed, when we say things like Hashem, let's say, being angry, loving, being vengeful, do these things not signify human traits? Or, at the deeper level, do these things not signify that Hashem is affected by external things, which would seem to compromise His perfection? Because if I depend on the other guy's behavior in order to feel good, if somebody can make me angry, that means that I'm not completely self-sufficient. Right? The greater the individual, the less affected he is by anybody around him. So if Hashem can be angered, does that not imply that, or if it's possible to displease Hashem, does that not imply that Hashem is to an extent, if we'll call it, dependent? That's true, but it's true in both directions. A person who is, it's true, it's the same question for mercy. You're right, but the other side also, to an extent, is a certain lack of perfection. Dependence is something that we wouldn't usually attribute to Hashem. When a person is merciful, it's a good trait, but as we've discussed other times, even that has to be controlled. When a person just can't handle the sight of something, it's certainly a virtuous trait, but still at the end of the day, it's a certain lack of perfection in the sense that he's affected by other things. He's not in absolute control of his state. This is a bit of a problem. What's that? In that sense, it's perfect. But we're talking about, again, you're not answering the question. You're showing that the other side is deficient too. But you're not answering the question.
You're defining perfection as not being affected by anything.
No, I'm saying the other way around. I'm saying the other way around. Being affected is a level of imperfection. I'm not saying that not being affected is perfection. I'm saying that being affected is a certain level of imperfection. But I don't want to spend too much time with the problem. This is the problem that was addressed last time. The way the Kuzari answered this, and I want to address this in order to put this into the proper perspective. The way he answered this basically was by saying that when you use any of these expressions that Hashem, it does not really mean that he was inherently angered. Because again, he's in a perfect state, he's independent, he doesn't depend on us to feel good. And therefore, all these different expressions that we use are really just manifestations of a system. Just as we say that a judge meets out justice, you might say that when he rewards somebody, he's being compassionate. And when he punishes somebody, he's being wrathful, even though there's no real wrath and there's no real compassion. He's working according to certain rules, and that's that. So also, when we talk about Hashem being compassionate, it means that it manifests towards us as compassion. But it doesn't actually necessarily mean that he was affected by a certain emotion. Hashem is not controlled by emotions. That was really point number one to recap, which we're going to come back and address. Now point number two, and this was the more problematic one, and here also this was brought to my attention that it was not properly put into perspective last time, is in a more broad way. By saying that Hashem wants something, that Hashem wants something, let's say specifically of us, does that itself not imply a certain lack of completion? That he depends on us, kibiyachol, to be fulfilled? These were the problems that we addressed, and basically, this question the Kuzari kind of answered by saying, it's a philosophical problem, but that doesn't change the reality that you see that Hashem did want things because he created things. But it still didn't answer our question. So, I want to put this into perspective of understanding as follows. See, by the philosophers, they were under the impression that they could comprehend Hashem. And the question is, how do we understand Hashem? Do we understand Him as a being that actually could be affected by our actions, which implies a certain lack of perfection? Or do we understand Him as someone who's completely above any desire, which means that He has no interest in us? That puts Him into a higher place as far as we're concerned, and therefore we opt for that understanding. That was the philosophical approach. Therefore we opt for that understanding. But, and basically this is the point we keep getting back to, even that, while it's giving, it's so to speak, crediting Hashem with the better of the two options, you are still working with the premise that you can understand Hashem. The question is which way to understand Him. And if I understand Him according to understanding number B, then I understand Him in a great, I understand that He's greater. But I understand Hashem. But we are, once again, working with the premise that we've said many times, that Hashem is completely beyond any of our concepts of understanding, including our concepts of logic. And therefore, yes, somehow, and we'll explain a little more how, but somehow, yes, it's possible for on the one hand Hashem to make a demand of us, while on the other hand He doesn't need it at all, and he doesn't depend on it for His satisfaction or fulfillment, while at the same time, He is satisfied when we do it. How could that be? It's a contradiction in terms. And that's what we already discussed earlier. That's right. In our level of logic, it doesn't work. But Hashem is not bound by our level of logic either. He's above all, He's even above that. And therefore, from where He's coming from, He can say, no, I'm completely perfect, and I don't need you to fulfill any desires of mine, and yet I desire that you do such and such. How do the two come together? Well, if you have to understand Hashem one way or the other, you have a conflict. But if you understand that Hashem is not bound by our logic either, He made the rules of logic. He's the one who created the fact that the two can't work together. So He's not bound by that. So therefore, in the sense of understanding Hashem, it's exactly, the whole point is that Hashem is something we completely do not understand. All we understand is things that He revealed to us. But you're right, that's exactly the point. The essence of Hashem is something that will never be comprehended by man. The essence of who Hashem is. Now this is a very, very fundamental point that's stressed in many, many Sfarim, that Nefesh HaChaim goes on about this at length, and in others, here he's kind of hinting at something that the Mekubalim much more harp on, how they stress and stress and stress that the essence of Hashem is just beyond any discussion. We're supposed to understand Hashem as much as we possibly can. Well, what does that mean? That means understanding what He chose to reveal to us, and understanding how He chose to reveal it to us, with the understanding that after all that's said and done, we still don't understand Hashem's essence. We understand what He wants to show us about Himself. And that's all. And therefore, here we come to the next point. Back to, let's say, love. Right? Love seems to be an emotion that you can't control. Right? So, does Hashem have emotions that He can't control? Can you control love? Do you decide who you want to love and who not? Or is love something that comes naturally and you can't change it? Maybe sometimes if a person is with you for enough years, he can ruin your love. But can you decide? Is love a logical decision? When each of your kids were born, did you sit down and contemplate it for a day and then decide, alright, love is not a decision. Love is an inherent emotion. Right? So how does that work with Hashem? Does Hashem have inherent emotions? So this really is the big difference between us and Hashem. And this is the Ramchal stresses. This is how it works with all the midas of Hashem. Hashem has midas. What we might call traits. The trait of rachamim. Trait of din. Love. Etc. Hashem has traits. But yet, they're not inherent. This is the key words. The difference between our love and Hashem's love is that with Hashem, love is a decision and a created emotion. Hashem created love and then uses it. And on that level, he actually feels it. But he could just as well decide not to, to do away with it. It's with, his, with all the midas that he uses. By us, these things manifest as inherent traits. But with Hashem, it's not like that. On a certain level, he decided to reveal to us love, which is something that he, a tool that he created and decided to use. As far as we're concerned, that's as real as any other love we're ever going to experience. But as far as Hashem is concerned, it's something, it's an external attachment. It's not something that's built in. There is nothing, nothing that we can say is a built-in part of Hashem, because when we're talking about Hashem's essence, it's beyond anything we can ever discuss. And the truth is, this bothered me for many years. I was bothered by this Khazari. Khazari says, anything that we say about Hashem's traits are only how they manifest to us, they're not on the essential level. And this very much bothered me for many years. Question, what does that mean? It sounds like it's a cold system. It only manifests externally that way, like the judge. He's not wrathful, he's just following a system and he's meeting out a punishment. He's not compassionate, he's just following a system, so therefore he's applying reward. And if we say that about Hashem, it basically comes out that love is not really love. It's just acting in a certain way that looks like love to us. And this very much bothered me, obviously, because the whole concept of Avas Hashem is based on that mutuality. But really the answer to that is this. The Khazari says that it's something external. He doesn't mean that Hashem doesn't experience love and that Hashem doesn't feel love for us. What he means is Hashem decided he wants to love and therefore he loves us. Well, the truth is, when we're talking about humans, we do have inbar. That's a big difference between us and Hashem. And that's really where this problem starts, because we're approaching it from our perspective. We have all kinds of inborn emotions and traits, so we relate that way to Hashem. Now, the truth is that, yes, by us they're inborn, and therefore we have to work with them. And yes, we do have to try to change them and adjust them. With Hashem, since they're not inborn, they're all decided upon. But once he decided, he really feels it. Just he's not controlled by it. What's that?
What do you mean?
It means that Hashem decided to love. And he loves. He really does love. But it's a decision.
When we love, we don't have the object of our love is pain. You can't possibly say
so the Chiddush is that even that is applicable to Hashem. Just again, the big difference, Hashem, and here we're getting to the finer element of it. How do we work with Tsar? Right? Tsar Shechina is a famous concept. Tsar Shechina is a famous concept. Right? How do we understand that? And the answer is, it's really the same as what we just said about love. Hashem decided that yes, he's going to put himself into a position where he, kiviyachol, does experience tsar. However, we'll understand that towards Hashem. But this is a decision that he made. And yes, the Sfarim tell us, Chazal tell us, that when the Jew is bitzar, Hashem is bitzar. The difference again between us and Hashem is that by us, it's completely against our will. We're helpless. With Hashem, he decided to experience it. He's not controlled by it. And the same goes also for what we talked about, desire. Hashem doesn't need to desire things. He's fine without it all. But he decided he wants to desire it. And here the Nefesh HaChaim says, this is puzzling, and he says, this is lamaisa, a mystery which we'll never know the answer to. Why did he decide to want to? In the first place, he didn't want anything. Didn't desire anything. He's not controlled by any desire. But he decided to desire. What motivated that decision? So he says at the end of the day, that's a question that we'll never know the answer to. Because the same way we can't understand Hashem's essence.
The decision, there is always going back to, we can't understand it. Even in the word decision, it implies a moment after or a moment before, which Hashem is not governed by time. So
that's right. That's right. That's right.
The word decision shouldn't really be applied to Hashem.
Well, all it does is, decision, you're right. Even decision, and this is mamish. This is the point, Imam is going through the Nefesh HaChaim with this whole discussion. What you said now, Nefesh HaChaim says that too. Even when we say decision, which implies that there was a process and a change. Oh, a change from the previous state, right? A change from the previous mindset, so to speak. Even that is really inapplicable to Hashem. So even that is only on the level that he chose to reveal to us, which is also because he decided to decide. Where does it start? It starts at a place that we can't relate to. It starts at a place where there are no decisions. How does that work? And here again, we come back to the answer that the essence of Hashem is something we'll never understand. All we're dealing with is the level at which he revealed himself to us. So the truth is, all we gain with the decision is not that now we understand how Hashem essentially operates. All we gain is that now we understand that the love is not something that controls him. It's not an inborn emotion. There's a decision that precedes all that. What about that decision itself? That also is not relating to Hashem's essence. That's preceded by something too. And this, yes, this is very big by the Mikubalim, that anything we'll ever grasp about Hashem is preceded by things that we don't. And the Mikubalim are always busy trying to get to that next level, right? So what's that level that we don't comprehend? They struggle to comprehend that, and then they see that beyond that there's a level that they don't comprehend. And this is what it's all about. So it really boils down to the understanding that where it starts will always be beyond us. Even that, the Mekubalim stressed that too, right? Again, Reb Chaim Volozhiner, etc. You say, why did Hashem created the world? Because he wanted to do chesed. But that desire itself didn't have to be. It's not a natural part of who Hashem is, because Hashem is not governed by any desires. He decided to want to do chesed. That's already on the level of revelation. Therefore, revelation started yet before the world came into existence. Revelation started already at the point that he desired to do good. But that's only the level that was revealed. What's behind that? We don't know. We can't know. That's already Hashem. That's right. Meaning we have to, any study of Hashem that we do, we have to do with the understanding that we are studying what He chose to reveal to us. And that there will always be the level that we just, it's just beyond.
Why would we try to understand Him?
What are we gaining? Because what He did reveal to us, He wants us to have a very strong relationship with Him. Which means that He wants us to connect to it in a stronger way we can, understand it in a stronger way we can, and live with it in a stronger way we can, as real a way we can.
I think the key is, what you said, is like the connection. Forgetting about the beginning, once the ball starts spinning, down to a connection. He wants some things like happiness or a connection.
Exactly.
We understand that because we have relationships, we have love with other people, children, even the baby. Why are we happy? Because there's a connection, because of the time we spend in our stomach.
That's right. Meaning on the level that He did reveal to us, in the reality that He revealed, there definitely is that desire, there definitely is that, well, the desire for the connection, the love, these are all real, intense realities, right? But it's in that reality where He revealed, right? So at the end of the day, in our interaction with Hashem, it's all there. The desire is there, the love is there, kiviyachol the tzar is there. But what we understand more than the philosophers is that that still doesn't compromise Hashem's greatness, because that's all on the level of revelation. But none of this, Hashem is not controlled by any of this, and Hashem could have just as easily not done it. Okay, that I hope is enough for this point. So now we move on.
Sorry.
Come on, go ahead.
So then the few things where I might think are difficult for Hashem, like making zivugim and splitting the sea. So we have a finite number of things where Chazal tell us it's difficult for Him.
Well, even that, if you note in these types of things, it says that it's kasha ki kriyas yam. So don't say that it's difficult for Hashem. It says that it's as difficult as splitting the sea. First, you have to know how difficult splitting the sea is for Hashem. So the point that Chazal are really trying to make is, don't view one as more of a miracle than the other. Right? Okay. Now, Omar HaKuzari. So we discussed all this. Now the king of Kuzar says, "Vayisbayli soida midas." Okay, now I understand the secret behind what we call Hashem's traits. Right? This is what we've discussed. V'nisgaleli havanas inyan kvod Hashem u'malachus Hashem u'shchina. And now I understand the concept of kvod Hashem, the glory of Hashem, right? When the pasuk says the glory of Hashem appeared to them, Kuzari had a hard time with that. What does it mean that Hashem is taking on some physical form, even if it's a refined physical form, even if it's a pillar of cloud, a pillar of fire, Hashem is taking on that form? What does the Shekhinah mean, right? The Shekhinah comes down. What does that mean? So he said, this has already been explained, that what this really means is, Shem Shemais Neiflim Al-Borim Nir Mitzel Nevin, that these really are all just things that Hashem decided to show them in the Nevi'im. Certainly they're not Him. The pillar of fire is not Hashem. Hashem is not a pillar of fire. Yet, this manifests His presence because this is how Hashem chose to demonstrate His presence. What is it really? Really what it is a spiritual creation and nothing more. But since it is actually done for the purpose of showing that Hashem is here, we relate to it as a revelation of godliness. Right. Like we said about Amud Anan, the pillar of fire, Veishe Cheles, the consuming fire, the pillar of cloud, the consuming fire, that's the burning bush. The Av Rafel, and the clouds, the fog, right, all that manifests in the Shekhinah HaSinai.
But what about Veishne HaKudim, dwells?
Same idea. It's the Shekhinah, right? It's all the same as this. Let's see. Ve'esh v'noiga, when we talk about Hashem appearing in fire, appearing in sparks. Va'asher noimar ala'or ba'boiker be'erev u'be'yema mu'unan. He said all these things are really, the mashal of this will be that when you see light in the morning before the sun comes up, or after the sun goes down, but you still see light. And when it's a cloudy day, you see light. Yeah? But you don't see the sun. The sun is out of view. She'll call it the sunlight. Now, is it actually sun? No. It's, the sun is out of view. But we talk about the rays as though they come from the sun. They really don't. You see a rainbow. Or when you see sunlight. What is sunlight? It's not the sun shining through. That's how we say it. But what is it? Really what it is particles of whatever that are reflecting the sun's light. Right? It's not... What is sunlight? Sunlight is not the sun. What is it? It's particles of whatever matter it is that reflects the sun's light. That's how rainbow works. That's how sunlight works. So too, when we talk about Shekhinah, right? The Amud HaAnon, the Amud HaEish, the glory of the Shekhinah appeared. What is it? Hashem Kiviyachol radiated something that appears in these things and serves as a demonstration of His presence, but it's not Him. Yet, we would still bow to these things. They did bow, right? When they saw the cloud appearing, they bowed to it as the manifestation of Hashem's presence, even though they understood that Hashem is not a cloud. So, Omar HaChover, so the Chover says, that's right. You got it. Keina kovoid nitzoitz or Eloiki. And you're right. When we talk about the Kvod Hashem, the glory of Hashem, really what it is again a reflection of Hashem's light, which shines through His nation in His land. So really, the Kuzari now is shifting into a completely new discussion. He's drawing off the old discussion, but we're really moving into a completely new discussion here, a new subject, which he sparked with this last word. That the glory of Hashem shines through. We are, so to speak, reflectors of Hashem's glory. By doing the mitzvahs right, it's like a prism that you hold up right to the sun, and if you get it right, it has the right effect, right? A rainbow. So that's what we are. We are reflectors of Hashem's glory. by positioning ourselves right with the right actions, etc., we reflect Hashem's glory. We manifest Hashem's glory, and Hashem's glory will actually manifest down on this earth. That's how it was meant to be, like the Kuzari described earlier. Hashem's Shechina manifests on this earth. How? Through our actions, we're actually causing it to be reflected. What's that? Yeah. Now, this works, he said, and here's the new discussion. What's the prism? It's the Jewish people positioned in the right land, right? You have to hold the prism right. It's not enough that the prism is made of the right stuff. You have to hold it right. So when the Jewish people are in the land, they reflect. And here, of course, we're moving into the discussion of why should land, or how is it conceivable that land, soil, would be a factor here. What's that? Well, he's talking about the spark reflecting Hashem's glory. I'm using the term prism just as a way of relating to the idea. So Amar HaKuzari. The Kuzari says, by now, I've already come to terms with the concept of a people that manifests, connects to, reflects Hashem's glory. Fine. Like we said, the mitzvahs, etc., all the satellite dishes which harness the Shechina and make it connect to us. But this business factoring in the land, that's already hard to accept. Why should the land be a factor? Land is land, it's material. So the sage answers, and here we're going to get into a beautiful discussion about the significance of Eretz Yisrael. Al yiksha beinecha, why do you find it so inconceivable? Shetesiachid echad eretz v'dava mikol ha'aretz. That one land would be more conducive for something than other lands. Meaning, really, the king of Kuzar is getting stuck on the same problem he had earlier. People are people, they're all the same. I can't comprehend that one should be more of a receptacle for godliness than another. People are the same. And now he's making the same argument about lands. So he says, why should the concept of not all lands being created equal be shocking? On the physical level, it's certainly so, right? You certainly do see that some soils are more conducive for one plant than another plant, right? Some soils will be a better place for one mineral as opposed to another. The chaya mibilade chaya. Not only that, some soils will be better at supporting some forms of life than others. Yes, the soil is certainly an important factor in the general atmosphere, the general state of that area. And sure, we see all around that different habitats, different places, will certainly affect the nature of the people who live there, the physique of the people who live there, etc. And not necessarily because one is better than the other, just because one is better for this and the other is better for that, right? Now we find that men don't just say, well, man is man and he can achieve independent of habitat, land, etc. It's not true. We certainly see that there are a lot of factors that contribute to man's mental, physical, etc. well-being, and one of them certainly is habitat. So of course we see that habitat is a very environment, right, where you are, is a very important factor on the material level. Why shouldn't it be so on the spiritual level? So Amar Kuzari, so the king of Kuzar says, alright, you're talking abstract, but in any Shemea, Amar Sheikhnim Be'eretz Yisrael, Yisrael Al Sharan She'olim. And the king of Kuzar is talking in the Golos. Who lived in Eretz Yisrael that time? I don't know. I think there were always some Jewish presence, but he had different nations occupying Eretz Yisrael at different points. He says, so you're saying that Eretz Yisrael also has that special godly conduciveness? I don't know that there's anything special about the people who are currently living there. Amar Chaver. So Chaver says, you're right. You're not going to see anything special about Turks living in Eretz Yisrael. ken harchem ze. Sha'atem oimim shematzliach ba'akev. He said, look, you Kuzari folks have a mountain that you say is great, is the optimal place for grapevines. Now, would that, if I just go to that mountain and take a walk there, would I say anything special about it if there are no grapes planted there? The fact that you say this mountain is wondrous for grapevines doesn't mean that grapevines are going to sprout there automatically. There are a few more conditions. You have to plant the grapes there. You have to work the ground. Then the soil will do its magic. But you can have a mountain that's the all-star of grapes. But you walk there, it'll be a barren mountain. Nobody bothered to plant grapes there. Or if they plant the grapes, nobody bothered to work it, to cultivate them. You'll walk there, you'll see a barren mountain that looks like any other mountain. So therefore, he says, same with Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael is the optimal spiritual soil. The optimal spiritual habitat. Now, its great conduciveness, its great quality, is it's when you plant the right seeds there, when you take that nation that's the ultimate nation, and you plant them in the habitat that's the ultimate habitat, you will be producing the ultimate product. Now, also that, you just take the nation and plant them there, it's not going to do it either. You take the nation, the ultimate nation, put them on the ultimate habitat, and then work it right, like with the grapes planted, you cultivate it right, with all the different actions, and tairas, etc., that it depends on, which is cultivating the grapevine. So there are three conditions in order to have this soil produce that ultimate product. You have to plant the right seeds there. It has to be the right soil. Plant the right seeds there and cultivate it right. With that, if you're missing one of those three conditions, again, it'll just look like any other habitat. We have to note that today also. That's the reason, yes, the Jewish people have settled in Eretz Yisrael. And nobody, up till now, was able to populate Eretz Yisrael in the way the Jewish people did. Nobody was able to properly settle it. Right? But yet, they haven't managed to screw themselves into the land in a secure way. They haven't managed to fasten themselves. We see that up till now, the situation is unstable. Right? Been around... Why is that? Because it's not being cultivated. So he says, it goes in both directions. If you take the ultimate grape and you plant it in tomato soil, you're also not going to get the ultimate product. So therefore, this ultimate people, the ultimate seed, they're also not going to reach that ultimate godly state unless they are placed in this habitat. It all goes together. Just like if you have the best grape seed, but you don't plant it in the right soil, it's also not going to produce that ultimate product. So if so, what he's saying basically is that yes, Eretz Yisrael is the land which was created for the purpose of cultivating godliness. And when you bring the people created for that purpose, and then you cultivate it there, you're going to produce the ultimate product of godliness manifest on this earth.
The big difference, though, with people, the father went through, like, what it is they did to show, to prove, to make them worthwhile that Hashem would choose them to carry on. But so far, nothing about Earth. Okay, it might be, for whatever reason, the ultimate conditions for spiritual growth, but that's only because Hashem decided.
That's right.
That it did.
That's right. With regard to the Earth, it was created that way. it's only with men whose whole essence is about Bechira that he had to turn himself into that. But you're right, it's just like with earth. In spirituality, there are a few factors. There's you and your Bechira, but then other factors are also place and time. Different places are endowed with more of a spiritual property than other places, and also different times, right? Like, for example, you can say Kiddush with the ultimate Kavanis, all the Kabbalistic Kavanis, etc., on Wednesday, you're not going to achieve a thing. So, yes, it's those people. Now, in the reality that Hashem created, He made pockets of time and pockets of place that have the properties that you can now take your Bechira and produce what can be produced there. So in other words, what he's saying is that godly connection cannot really be achieved. Godliness cannot really manifest anywhere other than Eretz Yisrael. The most basic nachkamina is...
Where did you say that?
What's that?
He said ultimately, what did you say that it can't be?
Oh, so you're right. You're right. It's like the same as saying, you take that grape seed, you plant it in a tomato soil, you still have a decent vine. It just won't be the ultimate because you're not planting it. That's true. But what we're saying here is the ultimate. Meaning the ultimate result you won't get. You'll get a much more inferior result. Now, the main manifestation of that is going to be Nevuah. Because Nevuah, as we've seen before, is the ultimate of that godly manifestation. When a person achieves the ultimate, right, really goes all the way, it manifests as Nevuah. Right? There you see Hashem actually appears to the person. He created that connection. Right? So that he's saying, since that's the ultimate, that can only occur in Eretz Yisrael. So Amar Kuzari, can the ultimate godly manifestation only occur in Eretz Yisrael? Can Nevuah only occur in Eretz Yisrael? Eichuzeh, how can you say that? There was plenty of prophecy going on in other places, from Adam Arisha until Moshe. Avram Be'or Kasdan, right? Didn't Avram prophecy have prophecies in Or Kasdan? In Mesopotamia. Achar Kach Yechezkel V'Daniel Be'Bavel. Yechezkel and Daniel both prophesized in Bavel. V'Yermia Be'Mitzrayim. So how can you say that the ultimate godly manifestation, which is Nevuah, can only be done by having that ultimate combination of conditions? The ultimate people in the ultimate habitat doing the ultimate cultivation. No, you see, Nevuah was able to manifest in Chutz La'aretz as well. So why are you telling me that it's the ultimate can only be achieved in Eretz Yisrael? So I'm out. So that we'll see. That we'll see. So I'm out. The Chavar says, no, you're right. You just showed me a whole list of people who had Nevuah outside of Eretz Yisrael. But I still maintain that Eretz Yisrael is where Nevuah must be cultivated. He says, yes. Anybody who had Nevuah was either in Eretz Yisrael. If not in Eretz Yisrael, it was for the purpose of Eretz Yisrael. Meaning, yes, there were people who had Nevuah in Chutz La'aretz, but it was all Nevuah revolving around Eretz Yisrael. So it was again in Eretz Yisrael Nevuah. Nevuah can only be either in or around with regard to Eretz Yisrael. Chutz La'aretz cannot produce Nevuah, can't sprout Nevuah. Oh, he's going to use that example. Let's see. Yonah is actually proving this point. Let's see. Hine nisna be'Avraham. Hine nisna be'Avraham kidei sheyavor bo. Avraham prophesied. Why did he? What Nevuah did he get in Chutz La'aretz?
Go to Eretz Yisrael.
Yechezkel v'Daniel mipanel. What about Yechezkel and Daniel? Also, Nevuah is about Eretz Yisrael, going back to Kamei Samikdash, things pertaining to Eretz Yisrael. Now, that's number one. The Nevuah that they got were about Eretz Yisrael. And besides that, the only reason even this was able to happen was because they had been in Eretz Yisrael. That's where, right, when you have a portable phone, it has to be around its base. That's the only place it can work. But sometimes, if it was on its base, you can take it a little bit outside the apartment, right? So here, once the basis for their nevuah was established in Eretz Yisrael, they were able to carry a little bit to Chutz Laaretz for Eretz Yisrael purposes. Asha b'imotzah, since they had been, the infrastructure was created in Eretz Yisrael, right? The whole nevuah contraption, they had been in Eretz Yisrael, in the Bayis Rishon, with the Shechina. Asha b'imotzah yom magia la nevuah kol amuchan la me'askula. It was only the people who were actually there when the Shechina was there that they could actually become receptacles for Nevuah. Afterwards, they were able to carry it to Chutz Laaretz to an extent. But it all begins and revolves around Eretz Yisrael. Now, Adam, you asked me about Adam. Adam, he hoisad Mosai, that's where he lived. Now, the Kuzari wasn't stupid. He was basing his question on the psukim that indicate that Adam actually lived more in the Mesopotamian area, right? But no, he lived there. Ubalmeis kasher kibam, and that's where he died. Meaning, Adam Arishan began in Gan Eden, but he wasn't there for very long. Where did he go from there? That the Torah doesn't tell us. Enter his Eretz Yisrael. Adam lived in Eretz Yisrael. After Gan Eden, Eretz Yisrael is the ultimate place on earth. Gan Eden, to an extent, was an above-earthly kind of place. But once he was out of Gan Eden, he was in the top place on earth, Eretz Yisrael. How do we know that? Kibama Orla Bazugais. Where is Adam Rishon buried? We know that in Maharat HaMachpelah there are four couples. Adam v'Chava, Abraham v'Sara, Yitzchak v'Rivka, Yaakov v'Leah. So, yes, Adam HaRishon also, most of his life lived in Eretz Yisrael. Before that, he wasn't on earth, as we'll see soon. Well, basically, but Chutz Laaretz is all the way out. Now, Ve'iya Aretz HaNikres Lefnei Hashem. And look at the expressions. Eretz Yisrael is called Lefnei Hashem, before Hashem. That's the place that's in Hashem's focus. About Eretz Yisrael, it says Hashem is always focused on Eretz Yisrael. That's where his hashkacha is focused. On other places, Hashem has delegates. Sorry, Eretz Yisrael kibiyachol is Hashem's quarters. Ve'aleh nafla kima ve'achenda. He says it was around Eretz Yisrael that the whole struggle between Ben Hevel and Kain, the Tchila, that was really what the whole struggle of Hevel and Kain was about. What was the struggle? Who was it that was going to be the one to continue Adam and get the land in which you can connect to Hashem? That was really what the struggle was about. It's hard to comprehend how we see various instances of people who thought that they can win the struggle by eliminating the competition instead of by competing. But that was what the struggle was about. The Azulose Keklifa. And once again, whoever would not get Eretz Yisrael, he would be on the human level like Chutz Laaretz is to Eretz Yisrael, like we described earlier. The shell of humanity. Not the real thing. The Ira Mashi Ira Me'arigas Hevel. And then what happened. Hevel was killed. Benisha Kain Ariri, and Kain was left, but he didn't gain because of that. He, on the contrary, was cut off. Benema Vayete Kain Lufne Hashem. And on the contrary, it says Kain went away from before Hashem. What does it mean that he went away from before Hashem? It means this: Sheyatza Migurash Me'aretz Hazois. Going away from before Hashem means leaving Eretz Yisrael. Being before Hashem means being in Eretz Yisrael. That's what all these expressions in Chumash mean, Lifnei Hashem. Sheba Hayu, that's where they were. Kain and Hevel at their fight were in Eretz Yisrael. When it says that he left from before Hashem, it means he was kicked out of Eretz Yisrael. Vayanav v'nod ba'aretz, and then he simply turned into a wanderer. And the same goes, we see by Yaino. Yaino got a nevuah that he wasn't so happy about. How can he ensure? Okay, he figured he'd have to contend with the nevuah he already got. But how can he ensure that he won't get more nevuahs? Answer was, Yaino wanted to get out of Hashem's presence. He ran to Tarshish. What does that mean? Yaino knew just as well as we do that Hashem is in Tarshish too. What he meant in this sense. Hashem's presence in terms of Nevuah is Eretz Yisrael. Once he's in Tarshish, sure Hashem sees him there. But Hashem is not going to connect with him there. There's not going to be any Nevuah there.
He's trying to prove that all Nevuah is related to Eretz Yisrael. Which just shows he had the Nevuah there.
He had the Nevuah in Eretz Yisrael. But then when he ran to Tarshish, his point was to escape. So that he wouldn't get Nevuah, and he was right. He would not get Nevuah in Chutz Laretz.
He didn't get Nevuah there too?
Oh, what happened? Like, Borach came in Kaima Nevuah. His purpose in running away to Tarshish. He wasn't trying to run away from Hashem. He knew that he can't run away from Hashem. He was trying to get to a place where he knew he won't get Nevuah. Hashem won't contact him there. That was true. Well, what did Hashem do? Heishiv Oisai, Yoelikim Eileo, Mimea Dogov, and Nibeba. Hashem made him get swallowed by the fish. He didn't get any Nevuah throughout that time. The fish spat him out. Where? Deposited him back in Eretz Yisrael. Then he got his next Nevuah. Yeah. So yes, the divine connection can only be achieved to the ultimate in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, as usual, we're stopping in mid-sentence.